Thank you for tuning in to this special episode of Movie Geeks United. For four decades, Stephen King has reigned as one of our most popular authors. His books have sold north of 400 million copies, and his easily accessible yet wildly imaginative works in horror fiction have set the benchmark for all writers who have followed. It was just a matter of time before Hollywood came calling, and they did, early on in his writing career with Brian De Palma's Carrie. Some 90 film adaptations have followed, varying in quality, of course, but attracting top talents like Stanley Kubrick, George Romero, John Carpenter, and Frank Darabont. Assessing this enormous contribution to contemporary cinema is a challenging endeavor, but Tony Magistrale took on that very assignment with his stunningly entertaining and insightful book, Hollywood Stephen King, a detailed and well-considered study of the many films, both failures and masterpieces, that populate King's cinematic resume. Mr. Magistrale is also the author of Stephen King, America's Storyteller. In this conversation, we discuss several of King's cinematic adaptations and the qualities that separate the very good from the unfortunate misfires. So tell me about your last class, because one of our last correspondences, you were about to teach a class and you had something like 75 students enrolled, Stephen King.
Right. Yeah, that was spring semester from January to May of 2012. And I had 70 students. The class filled in, I believe, less than an hour.
Wow.
Yeah. Which tells you something about, you know, the fact, you know, even though I think that Stephen King's career has peaked, and I think that his the quality of his fiction has, you know, has diminished slightly over the last few years. There's still this fascination with his work, and especially with the work that's been adapted from his novels and stories. And so the class was, when I teach this class, it's really one of my favorite classes to teach. I always try to do different things, but there are some chestnuts that have to go into the curriculum. For example, you have to do Carrie, because Carrie really began the Reign of Terror, you know, for his career, and of course for the films as well. You know, the novel was done in 74, the film came out in 76. In many ways, it catapulted both the Stephen King film phenomena, as well as De Palma as a director.
Absolutely, yeah.
And of course you just simply have to do The Shining. you can't do this course and not do The Shining. For reasons that are, I think, obvious to anybody in your audience. I mean, it's Kubrick, it's Jack Nicholson, let's face it, it's on everybody's list of top 10 horror films of all time.
It's iconic, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's iconic, that's right. And then you have to do, finally, The Shawshank Redemption.
Mm-hmm.
Because The Shawshank Redemption is on everybody's list. In fact, it's on everybody's list of favorite films of all time. I was perusing for this course the Internet Movie Database, and it was number one.
Absolutely. Above the Godfather films.
Above the Godfather film, I know. And of course, I made a copy of that, and I brought it in and put it up on the overhead for the students to show them this, and said, that's how we began the discussion of The Shawshank Redemption. I said to them, what makes this film the single most popular film in America, in the film canon? The American film canon. And that's how we started the discussion of Shawshank Redemption. Of course, then you can build around that. You know, then you can pick, I try to do different things every year, but you have to, those three are, well, it's like Led Zeppelin not doing Stairway to Heaven.
You'll feel like you're cheated if you don't cover
it. Like you're that's true. I mean, many of them already are pissed at me because I didn't pick the right film that they like the most. It's remarkable how many of them like It.
Huh.
My students are very fond. Well, think about it for a minute. They grew up with It. In many cases, It was their first horror film. They saw it when they were about 10 years old, because now, of course, they're 18, 19, 20. So they're looking at It as this throwback to their own childhood.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's the film that sticks out in their heads. And it's remarkable. I guess I just got to start teaching It more often. Because they're all disappointed when I tell them we're not doing It.
Hi, Georgie. Aren't you going to say hello? Oh, come on, bucko. Don't you want a balloon?
I'm not supposed to take stuff from strangers. My dad said so.
Very wise of your dad, Georgie. Very wise indeed. I, Georgie, am Pennywise, the dancing clown. You are Georgie. So now we know each other. Can you rest?
I guess so. I gotta go.
Go? Without this?
My nose!
Exactly. Go on, kiddo. Take it. Oh, you want it, don't you, Georgie? Oh, of course you do. And there's cotton candy and fries and all sorts of surprises down here. And balloons, too. All colors.
Do they float?
Oh, yes. They float, Georgie. They float. And when you're down here with me, you float down!
His book, It, I remember reading that upon its first printing, and I was just so taken by it, and I said, oh my gosh.
It's brilliant, isn't it? It really
it's
is
brilliant.
Brilliant.
It's the ultimate. It's everything thrown into the stew, and I thought, man, they need to make this into a film. So I was kind of disappointed by the TV treatment of it that Tommy Lee Wallace did.
Yeah.
But they're mounting a feature-length project, dividing it into two parts, as I thought all along would have been a smart way to go.
I agree. I agree completely with that. And I think that, you know, I have really mixed feelings about this. Of course, it's appropriate that we're talking about It right now because I think it's its 25th anniversary.
Wow! Yeah.
Since the book was published, it seems to me that it's some of his best writing. In an interview that I did with him back in, this would have been 2002, for a book that I was writing on the films that have been made from his work called Hollywood Stephen King, I asked him about why he chose Bangor, of all the places to move, after graduation from the University of Maine, Orono. And he said, he gave me a long explanation for that. And he said something to the effect of that Tabby, his wife, wanted to go to Portland. But he knew that the book was waiting in Bangor. And of course, the book was It, and Derry became Bangor. And we talked a lot about the way in which there are literal geographic places in Bangor that correspond to Derry. There is, of course, no Derry, Maine. There's a Derry, New Hampshire, but there is no Derry, Maine. This is part of the Stephen King geography that resembles, very interestingly enough, Faulkner's geography. Faulkner was one of Stephen King's favorite writers in college. And what King did was essentially to create his own Yawk-Napa-Tapa cycle. Instead of using Mississippi and Jefferson County, Stephen King used Maine. And there are those places like, for example, Bangor and Portland and some of the other smaller towns that appear that are actually main towns. But there's more that is invented, like there is no Salem's Lot, there is no Little Tall Island, and there is no Derry. And yet, of course, in creating this fictional microcosm, Stephen King has taken parts of the essence of Maine and fictionalized it. And he knew that in Bangor, his novel was there. And the book begins with an event that actually took place at a county fair in Bangor, where a gay man who was wearing makeup was accosted by some rednecks and thrown over a bridge and killed. And that began the cycle of violence, of course, that we witness in the novel. You know, there is this unholy collusion between the monster It, usually taking on the avatar of Pennywise the clown, and the townspeople. That they are literally, sometimes literally, in bed with one another. And I think, you know, up until he turns this absolutely wonderful clown into a spider, he's probably producing his best fiction.
I think so too.
And then it goes to shit.
Do you think it's because there's no real way to physicalize the concept of what it is?
That's a good question. I think he does a very, very good job of it with the clown.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a mistake to leave Pennywise.
Yeah.
Pennywise should have probably been the dominant. Well, he very clearly is the dominant avatar for it all through the novel and all through the film until the end, where it's reduced to a spider, and even more unfortunately in the film, a rubber spider. It's a real shame because the novel is so incredibly nuanced and detailed in terms of its ability to work with regional. It's a great piece of regional fiction, and of course, it's a great piece of supernatural fiction too.
Tell me your take on generally on his writing of character.
Oh, you know, I think that's one of the things that appeals to his millions and millions of fans, is that he creates these absolutely wonderful portraits of madness and of stability. You know, I mean, that's the thing that has always appealed to me about Stephen King, is that in many ways he's an archetypal American writer. In that his fiction, I think, moves in two directions and sometimes simultaneously. On the one hand, you've got this urge towards apocalyptic collapse. It's almost a dystopian world inside the brains of some of his characters. And I'm thinking of those that are completely unhinged, people like Randall Flagg, and so many of his portraits of evil that appear in Jack Torrance and The Shining. And on the other hand, you've got this almost oppositional, if that's a Dionysian element, then there's an Apollinian counterforce to it, you know, particularly in those main characters that he's got that seem to embody the best of the New England I guess I would call it New England resiliency and independence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in one of my first books that I wrote about Stephen King, I talked about the way in which I saw, you know, these characters in his work as being emblems of the American experience.
Mm.
That at the same time as King seems to be very much aware of the problems that America has faced in the last 30 or 40 years, and particularly the internal problems. I'm thinking of issues like divorce, drug addiction, child abuse.
Yes. Yeah.
These kinds of issues. And all of those things are central to it, aren't they?
Yes.
As well as The Shining. He also seems to have this understanding of, it's almost a right-wing fascination with self-reliance and independence. And, of course, that's almost heresy when you're talking about Stephen King, because he is so he's so progressive in his political views, and he's so critical often of American institutions. And yet he also at the same time uses as a counterbalance to those institutions these American independent men and women who have to go off, who have to break free of the community in order to survive, to keep their moral sanity and their moral health.
Mm. And the character at the beginning of his career who attempted to do that is, of course, Cary White.
Yeah.
Break free of the constraints of the abusive relationship she had with her mother and mm-hmm. try to make some sense of normalcy out of her teenage life.
Mm-hmm.
And I find,
isn't it interesting with Cary though? And this is the way I've always taught Cary. It's come to me over a long time, Jamie. You know, in thinking about this poor put upon girl. You know, she starts off with in the prison of the home. You know, a domestic prison, a religious prison that her mother has constructed for them. And then she goes into what I call the prison of femininity.
Mm.
You know, she has to conform, and this is part of her problem. And it's interesting that both King and De Palma understand this in the most intimate way with the, you know, of course, the menstrual issue that's at work in the shower.
Mm-hmm.
She has to conform to the trappings of femininity, and that means wearing a tampon. That means shaving her legs. That means putting on lipstick. That means wearing and getting a prom dress. And in both cases, they're prisons.
Yeah.
And yeah. she's never really given a voice of her own anywhere in that, either the film or the novel. She's always trapped by forces that are stronger than her. And I think that's the real tragedy of Cary, is that she never breaks free from these very different prisons. One is the prison of repression, and the other one is the prison of what I call the prison of femininity.
Hmm. But what I find about Cary, the film and the book, and I'm particularly pleased with it in the film, because De Palma is one of my all-time favorite directors, actually.
It's a great film.
I love the film. It's just how empathetic you are with Cary in that film. And it's an aspect of the horror genre in particular that I find very rare.
Yeah.
You know, usually they're the shrieking violent victims. You know, they're just there to be slaughtered in a horror film. But this is a very deeply felt work, I think.
Well, I think you get caught up in what you called earlier her attempt to find a normalcy.
Mm.
You know, I mean, you get caught up in that quest that she's involved in, and I think it's only after you start thinking about what normalcy means, you begin to realize that normalcy is defined by all those other girls, fitting in with all of those other girls that have been torturing her all through the film.
Yeah.
You know, and of course I'm very drawn to Chris Hargensen, the leader, the queen bee of the high school. I find her a very interesting villainess. Insofar as I keep asking my students, and I ask myself this too, why does she engender such hatred towards Cary? You know, does Cary represent that part of her that she fears, you know, without the makeup and the clothes and the boyfriends? Is this, you know, is there some sort of secret self that's being mirrored back to Chris through Carrie? I that's one of the things that I'm most attracted to in that film is you know, is Chris's motivation here. And I have to be honest, after all these years of writing about Carrie and talking about Carrie in classrooms, I'm still not convinced I have a complete understanding of Chris's motivation. And that, you know, that ties back to your earlier question about his characters. They're not one dimensional. They're fascinating studies of human beings, and especially as you start to make the leap into his middle work, and you start getting these women characters like Dolores Claiborne and Jesse Burlingame from that novel, Gerald's Game. And then he starts to complicate everything, because it's almost in the early part of his career he's really only interested in men.
When you've talked to him, and I know that you've gone through all of these films with him, because we had a conversation before that the only film you were kind of forbidden to bring up with him was The Shining.
That's right.
Does he feel that he's gotten a fair shot from Hollywood, more or less?
Oh, yeah. I think he's absolutely delighted by the attention that his work has received. Although he said at one point, I love this line, he said at one point, every time I go to Hollywood, I feel like I need a passport. I think that's one reason why he sells his films for a buck.
He does.
Yeah. Yeah, you can if you've convinced Stephen King that you're going to do something interesting with his work, and he makes a deal with you, you get the rights to his film for $1. Now, 10% of the gross then goes to Steve, and so does the right for him to help with the casting and the locale of where the film's going to be filmed, because he wants these films filmed in Maine whenever possible. And so does he get the right to press the stop button at any time. If in the course of making the film he thinks you're not quite living up to the bargain, but you get to take a shot at this thing for $1.
Do you see in terms of inspirations? Obviously, there are the literary giants of the genre that I'm sure that he recalls and draws inspiration
from. Like Faulkner.
Yes. But what about films? What kind of role do films play in his writing?
That's a really interesting and complex question that you've given me there. Let me start by saying that. I think that when Steve writes, he writes like a screenwriter. I mean, his novels, his fiction, I think this is one reason Hollywood is attracted to his work, is that it's very accessible, and it's very. These are straight up plots. I mean, Stephen King writes. He writes narrative, and by narrative I mean he writes fiction that has a good storyline, and it's primarily the story that King is interested in, and I think that's one of the reasons he's been so successful, and why he remarked to me on one occasion during one of the interviews that if you look at academic fiction. Academic fiction usually revolves around an academic environment where some professor has caught his wife cheating with the gas man, and the rest of the novel is going to be about what happens as a consequence to that. And King's line was, I couldn't give a shit about that. You know, he's interested in what happens if the wife gets caught cheating with the gas man, and a fissure opens up in the earth and something emerges from that.
Mm.
You know, he's not interested in what I would call typical plots. He's more interested in what if. What if this leads to this?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think as King began writing, he understood that he did not want to write books that were hard to read. And I don't mean that in a pejorative way. He wanted to write books that were accessible. He wanted to write books that were visual. And if you read his book on writing, which is one of the best things he ever wrote, you'll get lots of tips on how to be a good writer.
Yes.
It's a really, really fine book. And a lot of people here on my campus at the University of Vermont use that book in their writing classes just because it's so helpful for young writers.
Do you, in terms of horror writing, I mean, there's all kinds of horror writing, I would imagine, just as there are horror films. You know, there's the gross out, there's the icky factor, there's the jump up and scare you kind of factor, and there's the psychological, the kind of the type of horror that just kind of bleeds underneath your skin and stays with you.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think what kind of horror is he primarily interested in? Because he's indulged in all of those types.
Yeah, that was going to be my answer to you. That was going to be my answer. He pulls both of those strains together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's very. I mean, I think sometimes his worst writing is when he engages too heavily in the gross out factor.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, let's look at something like Gerald's Game. I don't know if you know that novel. Came out in the early 90s. It's about a woman who's having kinky sex with her husband. And she's tied to a bed, and the husband has a heart attack. And they're out.
I remember that. Yes, yes.
They're out in the wilderness in Maine, in a cottage, and a dog comes in, and the dog starts to chew the husband's head. You know, really not necessary. really something that could be avoided and still. The plot could be maintained. I mean, have the dog be circling the room because it's hungry and it's been abandoned. So it's a wonderful metaphor for the woman who's now tied to the bed, that she also has been abandoned by her master. So, you know, you got all sorts of interesting metaphors going there, but to have the dog start to eat the face off of her husband in front of her, really, really gratuitous.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, unfortunate. Well, unfortunate, but that's Steve.
Well, it seems to me too that you know he doesn't, from what I've the pieces that I've read of him, that he doesn't necessarily pre-plan every beat. But a lot of times, when he starts to write, he's surprised by what comes out, and maybe that's how he knows that he's got something good. But you know, I was thinking of the ending of Cujo, where he did not expect the boy to die, and he was he was pissed off about it. But he said, "Well, that's what the book turned out to be."
Yeah, yeah, that's right, that's right. And anyone who writes, you know, whether you're a dramatist or a novelist or a fiction writer or a poet, you don't really know what's going to happen at the end of the act of composition. That's why you write. Because you know, sometimes the ending is a stroke of white light, and sometimes it's just a plunge into the abyss.
Mm.
You know, it you don't know until you do it.
I want to talk to you about a couple of these movies, because there are quite a few of them. But I want to talk to you about The Dead Zone first.
Oh, sure.
That is a movie I adore, and it's one of those instances where director and author kind of meshed in a perfect way, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But that feels like a real period of growth for him, The Dead Zone. It feels like a very, it sounds so dismissive to say adult, but it seems like a very tragic kind of story that is elevated above some of the other material that he might have produced. I mean, does he feel a special kinship to that book?
He does. He's very fond of it. And his remark to me in that interview that I did with him was that it was like a combination of flavors that shouldn't necessarily mesh together, and yet they do beautifully, like chocolate and peanut butter.
Mm.
Don't forget, it's also a very adult film for David Cronenberg.
Yes. Yeah.
This is, this is typically not a Cronenberg film. I mean, it's a love story. And Cronenberg's love stories are always fraught with tension. And they never end happily. But this one is particularly almost melancholic.
Well, I think of his, obviously he has a penchant for body horror.
Yes.
But for me, my two favorite Cronenberg films are The Fly and The Dead Zone.
Yeah, those are good parallels, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And they share this kind of tragic... This tragic consequence at the end, and they're, The Fly in particular has a very powerful love story that I think drives it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just so haunted by the idea that this man who, in the Dead Zone, he ends up saving the world, and the world will always know him as a villain, as a kook.
That's right.
Oh, what a powerful character.
No, those are really good comments, Jamie, and I would also add that the other thing that Cronenberg, that these two films share in the Cronenberg canon is that his fascination with the male body, and the male body under assault. Most horror directors are interested in the unraveling and the dissection of the female body. But not Cronenberg. Cronenberg's really not that interested in women's bodies. He's interested in men's bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And when he does talk about women's bodies, as in Madame Butterfly, for instance, or M. Butterfly, it's the transvestite female that's actually a man underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's the Cronenberg... The Cronenberg focus is always on men who often get involved in sexual experiences, and that brings about their tragic fall. It's even the case in Crash. You've got men in Cronenberg, and of course the Dead Zone's a really good example. Men who suffer from some sort of psychic and physical impairment, and this creates a kind of cycle, a descending cycle that they can't escape from, that they're pulled into, and that ultimately destroys them.
Mm.
Maybe the only film that I know of that changes that pattern is The History of Violence.
Amy,
it's my daughter's name.
Your daughter's screaming. The house is burning. Your daughter's in the house. It's not too late.
Amy!
Tell me what your feelings are on Christine.
No, I think a B-level film.
Okay.
I don't think it ever rises above B-level, because again it seems to be centered exclusively on the plot, and it doesn't have very much psychological nuance or resonance to it, I don't think. I think it's okay, but I don't think it's one of the great films. But let's be fair here. We're talking about a canon of films that range somewhere in the neighborhood of 80 to 90 films now.
Mm-hmm.
And if we think about this critically, let's say Christine fits into a category of two-thirds of the films, namely that these are films that are not going to have great resonance in the American film canon in 100 years. These are not going to be classics, okay? Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of those. There's Children of the Corn, Firestarter, just a variety of films, The Mangler, a lot of other kinds of films that even Pet Sematary to some extent is probably going to belong into that category, even though I have a kind of fondness for Pet Sematary. But suppose we say, what about that other third? Or maybe it's just a quarter. Whatever. Those 20 films like Carrie, The Shining, The Dead Zone, Dolores Claiborne, Shawshank Redemption, The Green Mile, Misery. You know, and suppose we name those 20 films, because there are 20 of them at least, right? Mm-hmm. Give or take a couple, because we could argue about the quality of those. But those 20 films that have become part of the American cinematographic pantheon. How many directors, screenwriters, novelists who've watched their work be translated into film, actors, actresses, production companies, how many people wouldn't be pleased with a career that has had 20 films enter into the American pantheon?
Absolutely. Yeah. I can't think of another writer that's produced so many exceptional adaptations of his work.
And when you start talking about people, the directors and actors, you start talking about people like Clint Eastwood and Jack Nicholson and maybe Kathy Bates and, of course, Hitchcock and Spielberg. Pretty good company.
Yeah, yeah. Even so, you know, with so many films adapted from his work, and such a percentage of them that are kind of subpar.
Right.
I guess this is the double-edged sword when you become a popular author and people want to adapt your work in a film. Do the quality of the films cheapen the perception of his actual writing? His books?
I think so. I think he's run into a real wall there. I think that for a lot of people, I mean, if you look carefully, Jamie, if you do some research on the internet, there's never been a film journal that has devoted either an entire issue or several issues to the films that have been made of Stephen King. Mm. There are very few books. My book was really the first critical study of the major films that have been made from King's films, from King's novels. And there have been other ones that have followed mine. You know, I'm thinking of people like, his name escapes me right now. Let me see if I can find this for you. Yeah, here it is. His name is Mark Browning. And Mark wrote a film called, Mark wrote a book called Stephen King on the Big Screen that also took King's work seriously, took these films seriously.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, to come back to your question, there's not a lot of critical apparatus out there that has taken these films seriously and tried to give them the quality criticism that they justly deserve. I wrote an essay on The Shawshank Redemption, and there's a book that was written on The Shawshank Redemption that was published with BFI, but that was the only piece of scholarship that was available at the time that I was writing this essay.
Yeah, yeah. Was there, in your research and your writings of these films, was there kind of a hidden jewel, something that you didn't realize upon first viewing was so exceptional?
Well, I would have to turn to Shawshank Redemption. I realize that The Shawshank Redemption is a highly popular film. and that, you know, word of mouth has made The Shawshank, well, number one on the Internet Movie Database. But what I didn't realize until I started writing about The Shawshank Redemption is that there's there are some very interesting things that are happening in this film that most people who enjoy this film aren't aware of. If you've got a couple of seconds, I can fill you in on this.
No, I absolutely want to hear it. Yes, sir.
Okay. The Shawshank Redemption is a movie that's essentially about men in prison. There are really no women in this film at all.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I think this is really a movie that's all about women. All of the men who are in Shawshank have been placed there because they've performed some sort of heinous crime that has separated them from the world of women. And because of that, they behave in ways that are often, I think, aberrations of healthy behavior. I'm thinking especially of the sisters, for instance, those rapists who assault Andy all through the course of the film. Now, you know, Andy is in jail because he's wrongly convicted for killing his wife and her lover. A wife that has engaged in a kind of rebellion, a domestic rebellion from her marriage. And Andy, at the very beginning of the film, is just trying to survive. But in the course of the film, I think he comes to appreciate the importance of rebellion, particularly his wife's rebellion. Now let me try to define this a little further, because this is a complicated scheme that I worked out in this essay. Notice all the figures that appear on Andy's wall, those girly photographs, those girly posters that hide the opening of his vagina-like escape route that's going to take him down to Zihuatanejo. In Castilian Spanish, Zihuatanejo means the place of women. And all of those women, all of Andy's associations with women are connected in many ways to a kind of subversion. These are women like, well, for example, like Rita Hayworth in Gilda, who are essentially rebelling against the traditional role that they've been forced to hold. Raquel Welch in A Million Years B.C.?
Yes.
You know, yes. She has a similar role where she's, you know, she's thwarting the male patriarchy. And what Andy does in the course of this film is essentially, even as he becomes the warden's bitch, he also turns into a woman. He's raped. He has the role, a traditional role of the woman as a teacher of men, you know, who are in prison for many of them for more than decades, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, what Andy ends up saying is essentially that he's got to leave this place because this place no longer is working for him, just like his marriage wasn't working for his wife. One more example that Darabont put into this film. When Andy is in the one scene that stands out for most viewers is when Andy's in the prison office, the warden's office, and he puts on The Marriage of Figaro, and that music plays over the loudspeakers, and all the men are frozen in their place as they're listening to this. Well, there's a really interesting intertextual relationship here between this film, Andy's behavior, and The Marriage of Figaro. This is Andy has picked a moment from Act 3 when the Contessa and her housemaid are essentially talking about the Contessa's husband, the Count, who's trying to seduce the housemaid. And the two women are singing about, how do we prevent this from happening? How do we thwart the will of the master? And, of course, if you remember the scene itself, the prison warden comes in and says, turn that off, Dufresne, turn that off. And he turns it up.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So Andy's role all through this film is essentially that of the of the subversive women, subversive woman.
And what does it? I mean, what does it have to say about the nature of masculinity in light of your reading?
I think it's very critical of masculinity, very highly critical of masculinity, because masculinity would seek to repress and to hold down femininity and to keep it bottled up. You remember there's that opening scene where Andy's pictured in his car with a bottle of booze in his lap and his fist clenched. As he's thinking about killing his wife, he pulls out a pistol from the glove compartment and bullets fall out of the car. There's all this masculine rage. And in the course of the film, what I think Andy does is to take responsibility for his own role in the destruction of his marriage. He becomes a nuanced character in a way that women are nuanced characters. And men in the rest of this film are not, with the exception of Red, of course. And you know, one could even make the argument that what he does is form a marriage with Red.
Mm-hmm.
It's not homoerotic or sexual in any way, but it is a marriage where he has Red essentially follow his path to the wall where he made love to his wife. And there he invites Red to join him in Zihuatanejo.
Well, and there's something so soft and almost cherub-like about Tim Robbins. I mean, he doesn't seem hardened in any way. So I think that's perfect casting in that film for that.
I would agree too, and I also think Morgan Freeman's perfect casting as well.
Oh gosh, yes.
Yeah, that voice. You know, I mean, he's. You know, the question that the students always ask me is, whose film is this? Is this Andy's film or is it Red's film? And my argument is that it starts off as Andy's film and then it becomes Red's.
Hmm. How do they complement one another in your mind? Are they two sides of the same coin?
Andy's the teacher. In the way that his wife is the teacher, you know, in an odd sort of way, you know, though his wife leads him into an act of rebellion, an act of subversion, and I think what happens to Red is Red also becomes one of Andy's disciples, you know, get busy living or get busy dying,
mm-hmm.
You know, Red is put into a position where he's between. There are two extremes in this film. On the one hand, you've got Brooks, who is institutionalized, an institutional man.
Mm-hmm.
On the other extreme, you've got the women that Andy, because Andy's linked to all these various women all through this film. And Red's in the middle of this. And Red has to move from a position where music doesn't make much sense, and where art doesn't make much sense, and where checkers is better than chess, and where life is uncomplicated because he's given himself over to becoming an institutionalized man, he has to move to Andy's world. And that's why Red gets out. You remember that last scene where Red goes in front of the parole board and acts quite differently than he does in those first two scenes in front of the parole board.
Yeah.
And the last scene, interestingly enough, there's a woman on the parole board. The other two scenes before that, there are no women on the parole board.
Huh.
See how it keeps coming back in interesting ways to talking about women?
Yes.
Yeah. That was probably my biggest discovery in the course of writing about these films, is what happens in Shawshank. And I sent a draft of this to Steve. And he read it, and he really enjoyed it. He thought that was an interesting way of reading Darabont's film. And I don't think Steve was conscious of this at all.
Ellis Boyd Redding, if I'll say you've served 40 years of a life sentence, you feel you've been rehabilitated?
Rehabilitated? Well, now, let me see. You know, I don't have any idea what that means.
Well, it means you're ready to rejoin society.
I know what you think it means, Sonny. To me, it's just a made-up word. A politician's word, so that young fellows like yourself can wear a suit and a tie and have a job. What do you really want to know? Am I sorry for what I did?
Well, I...
As not a day goes by, I don't feel regret. Not because I'm in here, because you think I should. I look back on the way I was then. A young, stupid kid who committed that terrible crime. I want to talk to him. I want to try to talk some sense to him. Tell him the way things are. But I can't. That kid's long gone, and this old man is all that's left. I gotta live with that. Rehabilitated. It's just a bullshit word. So you go on and stamp your form, Sonny, and stop wasting my time. Because to tell you the truth, I don't give a shit.
But let me just say, you are good.
Thank you.
Your analysis is a big eye opener for me on that film.
Yeah, you won't when you hear this analysis, Jamie. You won't watch this film the same way again.
I know. I'm going to put it in as soon as we're done and rewatch it. I want you.
That's great. I've done what I've wanted to do.
Tell me what the in terms of the best directors that have worked with his material.
Right.
Are they like Darabont in that they take the skeleton of what King has given them and they kind of filter it through their own sensibility and come up with something that's a bit more elevated in a different direction?
Can we go someplace other than the director? Can we talk about the screenwriter instead?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Because I think that's key. it seems to me that what a screenwriter needs to do, the best films that have been made from Stephen King's work have been, the screenwriter has been different than Stephen King.
Yes.
You'll remember that Kubrick and what's her name?
Diane Johnson.
Diane Johnson rejected King's screenplay for The Shining, and it was later produced in 1999 in The Shining, the miniseries that ABC ran. But at the time, back in the early 80s, when Kubrick wanted to film The Shining, he didn't want to use King's screenplay. And I think that was the beginning of the animosity that developed between King and Kubrick, was
sure.
That King felt hurt that his screenplay was rejected by the master. But the best plays, the best films that have been made from King's work have always been written by other people than Steve. And what happens often, I think, in the process of creating the screenplay for the best of these films is that you take the skeleton in such a way where you're able to condense the King vision. Because the King vision is macroscopic, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, let's go back to the film you like, The Dead Zone.
Mm-hmm.
The Dead Zone is about a third larger than the film encompasses. What Cronenberg did and what the screenwriter for The Dead Zone did was essentially to compress King's novel. And that's why it has that kind of episodic feel to it, where you move from one moment to another. They all seem to be beautifully connected. And that's the brilliance of, I think, Cronenberg and the screenwriter. I don't know who did that now. I can't remember who did the Dead Zone. But that's what you have to do with King. And because King is the primary writer of these original texts, it's hard for him to know how to compress.
Sure. Yeah.
He's very reluctant in his novels to compress. And sometimes that works for him in a novel like The Stand, but sometimes it works against him in a novel like, for example, At Pupil, which should be about a third shorter than it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably, you could probably say that for almost all of his work. King's work would always be benefited if it was cut into about two-thirds of its original length.
Well, I think it's the age-old problem when you have an author adapt his own work. They're so married to the original concepts that...
That's right.
Yeah.
No, I agree completely with that. So I think that's key. I think, you know, you take the skeleton plot, which is always very good and always very rich, and you have to compress it down.
I wanted to ask about one other film in particular, because I remember seeing this opening night and thinking that it was one of the best of the Stephen King film adaptations, and it didn't get the notice it deserved upon first release, but I think as the years have gone by, the esteem has risen for it, which is Dolores Claiborne.
Oh, sure.
I adore that film, and it speaks to kind of the lasting impact of abuse that he's explored in several works. Do you think that this is a special film, too?
I do. You know, Kathy Bates won the Academy Award for Misery.
Mm-hmm.
Misery came out about 2 years or 3 years before Dolores Claiborne, and she didn't even get nominated for Dolores Claiborne.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she really deserved the Academy Award for Dolores Claiborne, because I think her work in that is even better than it is in Misery. As much as I like Misery,
it's
brilliantly filmed too. I mean, the way in which it works with, you know, and this is probably something for us to note. Some of the best films, not all of them, but some of the best films that have been done of Stephen King's work have been done with a very close relationship to the natural world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, think of the importance of Maine to Dolores Claiborne.
Mm-hmm.
That it's set on an island, that it's somewhere in between seasons. This is not Southern California. You know, this is very clearly the northeast corner of the world, where there are actually six and not four seasons. There are those in-between seasons that we're starting to head into here, somewhere around November, where it's not fall and it's not winter. And, of course, there's mud season that's somewhere between March and April that's not winter and it's not spring. And if you think about that film, the present tense of that film is set in one of those six seasons, in two of those six seasons. You know, it could be mud season or it could be fall. Hard to say which season it is, but the fact that it's drained of color, the fact that it's gray, the fact that it's in between in a film where an island and the mainland, and so much of what happens in this film occurs on a boat, a ferry that goes in between the two worlds of both Little Tall Island and the mainland. You know, think of how important those ferry rides are to the plot of this film.
Yeah.
And, you know, in between places. And, of course, the switch to color as a way of contrasting a presence that has been completely drained of meaning. This is one of the reasons why he liked Faulkner so much. Faulkner's novels do the same thing. They're always about a past that's more important than the present.
That's such a smart observation, because these are characters that are in limbo.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something unresolved in their lives, and they have to kind of navigate their way to that place.
That's right.
We were talking about condensing his material and his books and how they breathe, and maybe they breathe a bit too much.
Yeah.
But, you know, it would seem, in light of that, the television format would be ideal for his work. Do you think he's had much luck with the miniseries?
I don't. I think that they've been very mixed. I'm not really terribly fond of any of the miniseries that have been shown on television. And there are a lot of reasons for that. You know, some of it has to do with the commercial enterprise of television that keeps interrupting the storyline.
Mm-hmm.
And that the writing, the writing for almost all of these miniseries have been written by Stephen King. I don't think any of them have not been. So Steve has to write as the telewriter. He has to write for these commercials so that the breaks occur at certain points in the storyline every 15, 13 minutes. So that interrupts, I think, the flow of the plot. I don't think Steve works well on his own work. I think the last 20 minutes of Storm of the Century, again, another main film that really is so connected to the natural world. The last 20 minutes of Storm of the Century is the best that you're ever going to find on television from Steve.
You know, I was going to tell you, I think that's my favorite of his television work, is Storm of the Century.
Certainly the last 20 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
You really have to earn the last 20 minutes. I mean, give me what I want and then I'll go away. Please, whatever, just take it, just go away.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
just so dragged out. And The Shining's the same way. You know, if King's complaint was that Kubrick didn't show the de-evolution of Jack Torrance's character well enough in the film version, well, King goes to the other extreme.
Uh-huh.
In his screenplay, there's way, way, way too much attention to the alcoholism, and it drags down the plot. I think the same thing happens in Storm of the Century. Again, you condense Storm of the Century by one night. Instead of doing it in four nights, you do it in three nights, and you put all the emphasis on that last section that you and I both liked.
Mm-hmm.
And it's stunningly good.
Yeah.
Stunningly good. That's the best one of all of them.